farmer's son turned con man and self-proclaimed doctor, Charles Lewis Blood used laughing gas and lies as a ticket to his swindle's success. Stay tuned to hear how Dr. C.L. Blood conned countless patients and practitioners into believing he could cure their ailments. I'm Courtney Green.
I'm Katie Reeves.
And I'm Ezra Coopersmith. And this is Swindled and Psyched, the podcast where we explore some of the most successful scammers and hustlers in history, talk about why they worked, how they're still working, and what you can do to make sure you don't fall for them.
This podcast is brought to you by Better Business Bureau Great Western Pacific. The BBB has helped consumers find trustworthy businesses for over 100 years. With resources like Scam Tracker and online business records, finding trust in the marketplace is easier than ever. Visit BBB.org for more information. The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and do not represent the opinions of Better Business Bureau, Great Western Pacific.
Oh, C.L. Blood.
And can we actually call him Dr. C.L. Blood?
Because I mean,
allegedly
a doctor. And this, I kind of wish we had started with this one, or at least done this one a little bit earlier in the season, because we've talked a lot about people in power and how that plays a huge role in the deception of basically the people who get swindled.
Mm-hmm.
What is that called again, Katie?
Good question. There was... Honestly, off the top of my head, I can't think of the exact term. I know I've talked about it in other podcasts that may have not seen the light of day. I know I could look it up.
Just for our listeners' knowledge, we have done several of these that we just didn't end up liking or enjoying, and so we ditched them. The stories were good, but we didn't love them as much as we loved some of the others. So, C.L. Blood is an interesting character. It's one of those 1800s stories that, I mean, we talk about it all the time. It was just a different time. We're really lucky to have the internet and a lot of the resources that we have now so that these kinds of cons don't occur on the same scale. At the same time, it's also kind of a downfall that we have the internet because it sets a lot of these cons up. This story makes me giggle a little bit.
Because it involves laughing gas?
So punny, our good old friend Katie. It's another one of those stories that someone went to great lengths to cover up their con. So, I mean, I might as well just get into the story before I give away too much, because that is what I do. Apparently, I've been told by so many people that I give away too much in the beginning before I even tell the story. So let's dive in. Charles Lewis Blood was born in Groton, Massachusetts in September of 1835. I see Ezra fist pumping. Is that close
Boston,
to where you grew up?
I actually have no idea where that is, but I mean, it's not a very big state, so probably. Wait, give me the name of the town again.
It's Groton. Groton.
Groton.
I hope, yeah.
That sounds like every other
town in Massachusetts.
Well, hey guys, yeah. Hot take. Ezra is from the same state as this potential schemer.
Related? 200 years later.
Yes!
Is maybe it close?
Maybe you guys are related.
So the only thing that's coming up is Brockton, which I absolutely know where Brockton is. But not Groton.
I wonder if this town this town was renamed at some point.
Yeah, it could have been that could definitely be just absorbed into another town or city.
Absolutely. Anyway, so Charles Lewis Blood was born into a very successful and farming family. So they did all sorts of farming. They dealt with timber and they were contractors and they were just really, really reputable folks in their town. Although Charles came from this really successful family, in his adult life, he often lied and told people his father was a doctor. Charles also claimed that he was a doctor, even though he never received any formal training. His medical credentials were often in question, but he marketed himself as Dr. C.L. Blood and even authored a book on medicine. His con career started in 1865, when Charles was about 30 years old, and he moved to Boston to establish a medical practice. He could only afford to rent out an office in a rougher neighborhood, but he didn't let that stop him from finding his place in the city. He began to promote his medical services in full-page ads in local and national newspapers. Around this time, he developed an interest in nitrous oxide, which many of us know as laughing gas. Charles learned how nitrous oxide was manufactured, duplicated the process, and claimed the invention as his own. He marketed his new cutting-edge product as oxygenized air and claimed it cured various diseases in the throat and lungs. His thriving business enabled him to move into a more expensive part of Boston. He continued to advertise the ability to cure lung and blood diseases with the air he administered in his office. When success stories weren't pouring in from his current clientele, Charles hired a group of gamblers and con men to spread false stories of miraculous recoveries after his services. Impressed with the success he had after hiring the misfits, Charles offered them all jobs selling his products all over the country. While he maintained a practice in Boston, Charles gained a rival named Dr. Jerome Harris, who was also using nitrous oxide. Dr. Harris, who was technically a real physician and classically trained, called his air super oxygenized air and marketed it for the same medical purposes as Charles. In the winter of 1867, Dr. Harris was visited by a Mr. Carville who suffered from bronchial issues. Harris administered his super oxygenized air, and immediately his patient started convulsing and foaming at the mouth. When Dr. Harris sent Mr. Carville home, he immediately went to Charles, who was apparently his normal physician, to tell him about the horrible experience he had had with another doctor. The next day, Charles ensured newspapers had slandered Dr. Harris's name. Mr. Carville claimed that Dr. Harris poisoned him during a treatment and claimed his methods were fraudulent. Dr. Harris's legal counsel urged him not to settle with Carville because they believed Charles was blackmailing him. In 1867, Charles decided to leave Boston and move his practice to various cities in the Northeast and Midwest. His known practices were in New York, then Chicago, to Philadelphia, and back to Boston by the late 1880s. It's likely he set up shop and took on clients in other cities, but he never promoted his appearances anywhere else. Charles was arrested several times during his career, once for blackmail of another physician, which wasn't the blackmail of Dr. Jerome Harris. It was an entirely different situation. Twice for tax evasion, twice for conning investors, and again on murder charges, which is an entirely different story about Charles making friends with someone in prison and murdering their brother, but for another time. Charles died in 1903 at 73 years old in Manhattan. He had served time for many other crimes, but never for conning people into thinking he was curing them with laughing gas. And that is the story of the laughing gas cure. So Charles,
honestly, I feel like I could cure some of my ailments with laughing gas.
I feel like you're a super giggly person already. I don't know. I don't know that you need it.
It just sounds lovely. Just go to a doctor and you're like, can I just huff some laughing gas, please? Thank you. That'll cure my ailments.
Really? Did you never get your wisdom teeth pulled, Ezra?
Never had my wisdom teeth pulled. Hmm. Although I might have to in the coming years. Never had a root canal. Nothing.
Ooh. So you've never been, you haven't been put under either for any reason?
No, actually, I've never been under anesthesia, period. I've been under like localized stuff, like Novocaine, but
that doesn't count.
Yeah, I've never had any surgery that required general anesthesia. Nothing.
See, I had that when I had my wisdom teeth out. They put me out, and I'm grateful for it. I did not want to be awake.
That's
like, put me under, put me out. I don't want to know a thing.
One of my good friends recently had, he like tore his ACL a few years back, and he had to have another surgery recently. And I guess he convinced his surgeon to let him not go under and watch.
Ah, so he could watch it? Ooh, some people like
it didn't,
that.
No, it did not go well. He had to go under like partway through. Oh.
Well,
I mean, the surgery went well, but he noped right out of there.
I don't, I wouldn't, no, 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 no. I don't want to see, I don't want to know. Give me the good drugs and give me all of them.
Same, I just want to go to sleep and wake up. And never have to think about it.
To all of our listeners.
Anyway.
I'm actually 6 weeks post-op. I had surgery a week before we aired our first podcast. And that was something that they asked me, is if I didn't want to go under. They would make it so I couldn't feel anything.
Of course.
But it would have... I had surgery on my stomach. So they were like, we can just put a sheet up if you're worried about anesthesia. And you don't have to watch it, but you can be awake and talking to the doctor. And honestly, the surgery was only 35 minutes. It only took them 35 minutes to complete my entire surgery. Prepping was way longer than that.
Yeah.
So I honestly shouldn't have even gone under. I should have just chatted with the intern next to me.
I mean, I don't know. I'm just shaking my head because I don't think, but I'm such an anxious person. But so are you, Courtney. I don't know.
I sure
maybe,
am.
You know, with those sweet drugs they give you to, you know, not feel anything, I'm sure they'd also slip in a little relaxation. So
no,
you're
they
just,
absolutely do. They give you know, sedatives before you're just, surgery.
But, you know, I would still. I personally, I just love that feeling when they put in the medicine into your IV and they're like, count down from 10. And you go, 10, 9. It's the best.
See, but I don't ever remember that with laughing gas. I think it just made me giggly and a little delusional. So I'm not sure why, under any circumstances, Charles Lewis Blood would think that it would solve any bronchial or lung issues.
Well, I mean, he also wasn't a doctor, so I think he just made that up. I mean, to sell it. And
I mean,
listen,
it's a good excuse if you're living in the 1800s and just want to get high on laughing gas.
Well, and laughing gas.
Oh, no, this is for my breathing issues. And no one could prove you wrong because no one knew anything about
it. I would have, listen, if I lived in today's world and they were like, listen, laughing gas can have a positive effect on your lungs, I would be at the doctor's office. I can't. Help, air. I need laughing gas. So even again, it could be, it doesn't have to be in the 1800s for me. It could be 2021. And they could say, you know what really helps curb COVID? Laughing gas. I'd go, I knew it. Sign me up.
You know what really helps anybody's mood or really any ailment? It's just laughing and being happy.
Well, which kind of brings me into, if you wanted to dive in a little bit to
roll with it, Katie.
The psych of it. I know we talked a lot of, we just, you know, took people on a journey about surgeries. But looking into, because I'm always interested in, yes, this happened back in the 1800s. Sorry, Courtney, I didn't memorize the exact date.
No, that's okay.
But the thing is that it also happens now. I mean, as many advancements as we've made with the internet, there's so much different information out there that isn't verified that you can find any article, any blog post, any YouTube video to validate something, literally anything you think, right. Let alone something medical. So it's something that still continues to happen. And so a couple things, I mean, because I think maybe there were multiple things at play here that are still at play. One is the placebo effect, which this is something that is a very common, you know, a common phrase. A lot of people use it, you know, to say, oh, the placebo effect. And, you know, if you're not familiar with what that means, essentially it's when it's more so is speaking to research and studies, because placebos have been used to determine whether or not a drug is effective. So if you have two groups during the study and one group is getting the placebo and one group is getting the actual medication and they do not know which one they're getting, if both groups have the same reaction, it's deemed that the drug didn't work or it's not effective, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. the people who aren't receiving anything are having the same reaction. So therefore, okay, the drug's not working. More recently, though, what they're looking at, instead of looking that as, oh, well, it doesn't work at all, looking into it further to see if there's another neurological mechanism in place. Because even though the placebo effect is meant to say, oh, well, you just made up the fact that you're feeling better, or you just... Yeah, it's a powerful, powerful thing. And what's important to note is that the placebo effect, or a placebo, this is not something that's going to cure a tumor or cure diabetes. This is more having to do with something neurologically based, like pain management. Mm-hmm. And so one of the professors that came up when I was searching this was Professor, and I hope I'm saying this correctly, Kapchuk. And he works at a Harvard-associated hospital. And he has done a lot of research with placebos. And, you know, he'll be the first to tell you, placebos may make you feel better, but they will not cure you. Right. And so, you know, really looking at, it can help with stress-related insomnia, pain management, and, you know, cancer treatment side effects like fatigue or nausea. Again, though, these things that can be impacted by the placebo, it's not necessarily, you know, a physical tumor or an organ that's not producing insulin, for example. So one thing that he did that I thought was really interesting, to see how placebos work, and now what they're thinking, so again, it's more of a complex neurological reaction. So they're thinking involving, you know, the feel-good neurotransmitters like dopamine and epinephrine. They're thinking that there's an increase of that. They're not exactly sure why or how. They just know that, okay, the placebo effect can be powerful. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to discount that. And he did a study in 2014 to test the effects of a placebo. So there were three groups, and they all were taking, they're going to be taking medication, quote unquote, for migraines. And so there was a group that had the actual medication that was marked, you have this medication. And then another group had the placebo, and then another group took nothing at all. So the people with the placebo were still taking a pill. It just wasn't effective. And they found that the placebo was 50% as effective as the real drug to reduce pain after a migraine attack.
Wow.
That's not nothing. And they think a lot of that had to do with the ritual of taking a pill. They're also looking into that. How does a ritual impact the placebo effect? Because for when doing these studies, it's not just that these people in these clinical trials are just taking a pill, the end. No, they're going to the clinic, they're getting evaluated, they are going, in order to, you know, those controls for the experiment, they're going through the exact same process. So they're really looking at, okay, there's the placebo, but also the ritual of taking a pill, which for most people is positively associated with pain relief. So even just taking a sugar pill can, in this study, 50% as effective as the actual migraine medication. So wow. There's that piece where, hey, people were going in for different ailments. Laughing gas probably did help on some level because, hey, makes you happy, makes you feel good. And they're getting a treatment from someone they perceived as a doctor. Was he? Doesn't sound like it, but they thought he was. So, hey,
that's so interesting.
Who says it's not? I mean, it's effective. Clearly, a placebo can be effective and does have an impact on how we function. So there's that piece. The other piece is, and Courtney, you mentioned this earlier, is the authority piece of it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly what term you were referring to. There was a study, again, that I had brought up in a previous podcast, but I don't think it's seen the light yet. So we're just going to dive in now because authority can apply to a variety of situations and have an impact. So even though this is a different case we're talking about, it still applies. So There was an article that I found, or a study that was put together by David Gregg, and he was looking at social engineering. So how, specifically for that one, he was looking at how do people who are looking to get personal information in order to potentially do a scheme, how are they getting information from people? How are they engineering us to provide that information? And one of the things that was looked at is authority. There was a study done back in 1993 by Robert Saldini. And so this is, you know, in 1993, so it's not a super recent one, but I think it still really applies because, again, human behavior hasn't really changed. So in this study, there were 22 separate nursing stations that were contacted by the researcher who identified himself falsely as a doctor. He did not use the name of a doctor currently at the hospital. So this is a name he knew that the nurses had never heard before. And he requested the nurse answering the phone give 20 milligrams of a specified prescription drug to a particular patient. So there should have been 4 different red flags here based on the hospital's policies. So it came from a doctor who the nurses have never spoken to because it's not an actual doctor. Mm-hmm. They were transmitting a prescription over the phone, which is a violation of the policy, at least at that time. The drug in question was not authorized on any of the wards that he called. And the dosage of that particular drug is twice the maximum daily dosage. So there should have been 4 different flags that popped up. However, what do we think the percentage was? Courtney, 80. You may remember.
Is it 80?
95% of cases, the nurse proceeded to obtain the necessary dosage and was on their way to administer to the patient when they were stopped and told of the study. Now, this is not to say, look at these dum-dums going around, not following protocol. No, that's not what the point of this is. The point of it is to show how much authority we give people without a second thought. We are trained to respect people in uniform. We are trained to listen to people in authority to our detriment, to the point where we don't question things even if we think something feels off or, you know, if it's just... or you just don't even think of it. You just go with, hey, a doctor told me this. We're just going to go. I'm going to do this. And then, you know, in this particular case, it luckily was just a study and it's not, no one was hurt. But I think that also can be a piece of it. He was telling people he was a doctor. I'm sure they trusted that. So I think that also could be a piece of why he was able to continue.
I think it also has something to do with the lack of technology back then. So today, if the same thing were to happen, then there would be scans and tests and things that we could prove that their condition was getting better or worse. Whereas back then, if they felt better, they probably thought they were actually getting better. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, that's one of the major differences, but it's so interesting. Ezra, what does that look like today? What does something like this look like today?
Yeah. It's funny you say that, you know, this probably couldn't happen today, because to some extent you're right. Like, if somebody tells you they're a doctor, you can find out if they're really a doctor pretty quickly.
Oh, absolutely.
And if they say that they're going to treat you with a drug, it's pretty easy to get a lot of info about that drug. But we still, at BBB, frequently, regularly, we get complaints about basically the same type of issue, which is people being sold products that are supposed to be good for your health or cure a certain issue, and they straight up don't, or there just isn't evidence that they work, or there isn't enough evidence. Before we get into that, I think it's kind of important to acknowledge, I mean, at this point we're like a year and a half in, but I do think it's funny that we're talking about this during a pandemic. Which I know that every time we talk about anything, we say like, and in the age of COVID-19, this is it. But I mean, it is especially relevant over the last year. We have this giant public health scare. For a while, there really weren't treatments. And we did at BBB see and get reports of a lot of misinformation.
There were some
public instances of... It's not funny, but, you know, people like putting bleach into their bodies because
I wonder where they got that idea
that it would work. But also, I mean, even at BBB, I remember talking to Anne, who at our Denver office handled ad review, and she was telling me about a business she was dealing with that basically marketed it. They were selling, I forget exactly what it was, but it was like a vitamin C supplement, and they had somehow gone from point A, which is that, you know, vitamin C may have some role in immunity, gone from point A to point B, which was marketing their product as something that could be used to treat the coronavirus. And this was before there was a vaccine, before anything. And, you know, when Anne challenged them. COVID. Yeah, but so here's the
thing.
Trying
to contain my rage.
Yeah. It was expensive, obviously, but
of course.
You know, she asked them to substantiate that claim, and of course they gave her, you know, a link to like a published study supporting the idea that vitamin C helps with immunity, but nothing about how much of it is in their actual product, how that makes its way into your body, how that interacts with everything else. I mean, it's completely unsupported.
Right.
But even outside the context of COVID, we have been getting reports about those kinds of businesses and continue to. So BBB actually did a national – yeah?
Sorry.
I'll just put a pause on the
– In recent news, actually, the Federal Trade Commission is starting to prosecute businesses, and primarily I think the first one was an actual physician of some sort that was claiming that they were curing or preventing coronavirus, and they actually made a lot of money on that. So I know that there's actually action against a lot of businesses that were doing that.
Good.
And something to note too, that maybe a lot of people don't know about, is that Better Business Bureau actually looks at advertising claims.
Mm-hmm.
We look so deep into that. We have a whole team that looks at advertising. So if you're ever curious what it takes to be a BBB accredited business, it's basically you have to be trustworthy all the time, because if we catch
you... And transparent.
Yeah, if we catch you doing things wrong, you get one roll brief window of time to make it right and to be honest with your clients, or we let people know what you've done, whether it's putting a warning on the BBB profile or calling attention through social media or the news. We're not here to slander anybody, but we want to make sure that companies know how serious false claims are. And being a good, credible business is so important, because your clients are putting a lot of faith in you. And that faith and trust needs to be earned. and maintained. And so that's a big part of what we do. Anyway, I'm sorry for taking over here. Tips, but Ezra, go for it.
So that's really important. Yeah, I guess, well, to continue, to use a medical word, I guess, we've really been seeing, like, what you can call an epidemic of, so at our BBB, we categorize them as health and diet companies, but over and over and over, they don't go away. We get complaints about these companies that sell face creams and diet pills and other really wacky things, like pills that are supposed to make you smarter or boost your libido or solve all these other issues. For the most part, the claims are totally unsubstantiated, and the businesses also just lie. So, and again, this isn't, I'm not going to say that's the case for every one of these online businesses selling these products, but there's an obvious pattern where they'll come up with fake celebrity endorsements. They'll send people basically to their product pages by writing these like fake blogs. So they kind of look like they're from like a blogger who's recommending the product. It's actually just the product putting them out. And one of the really tricky things that they do, and frankly why people complain about these businesses over and over and over again, is that they set up what are called continuity programs, but they don't disclose it. So what happens is, as a consumer, you see like a social media ad for, I don't know, a diet pill. You go to the landing page, and what you see is, hey, you can get a free trial. All you have to do is give us your card info, because you have to cover like $3 in shipping. Right. And what ends up happening is either it's not disclosed at all, or there's like tiny print that you can't even read, or it's hidden in all these like flashing lights and photos. But you somehow either agree or just sign up without knowing that you're going to be in a membership program. So people get what they think are free trials. All of a sudden they're out like $200. And what's even worse is, often they can't even get in touch with customer service. So it's a while before they can even cancel, and they're out hundreds of dollars. And they're getting a product that, you know, it just doesn't work. For all you know, they're like glucose pills.
Well, I was just probably banking on that old placebo effect, because it's a lot of times these businesses give very general results. Oh,
exactly.
Your libido will increase. Well, what does that mean? I mean, that could mean any. I mean, there's people could define that any way they want, really. Everyone has their own definition of what that means. So, hey, if you take a pill, who's to say you don't have that placebo effect, and that you convince yourself that, hey, but, you know, that's not going to work every time. So obviously there's going to be people who come back and say, oh, this product's an issue. And hang on, why was I charged $150 for supplements I didn't want?
Yeah.
Well, what are good practices if people are really interested in these things, though?
So before I talk about good practices, I think what kind of informs that is this idea of, Katie, you brought this up, but it's, today you can find so much info online that, I mean, even for like, even when we talk about basic things, like whether the earth is round or flat.
Yeah.
If you want to believe the earth is flat, you can probably convince yourself of that by doing, I'm using air quotes, but research, and by watching YouTube videos. So when it comes to something like the efficacy of a drug, most of us are not prepared to do, again, I'm using air quotes, research by Googling and, you know, pretending that we understand the scientific research in its totality. So the reason I bring that up is that if you Google something and want to believe it's true, you're probably going to find info convincing you that it's true. But the best thing you can do in these instances is listen to what experts have to say. So if it's some sort of a medicine or a supplement, look at what actual medical experts have to say. Talk to your doctor. read from a trusted source. Don't believe the first thing that you're handed by the person who's trying to sell it to you.
Well, I just wanted to say, because a lot of what I do for this podcast is specifically looking for research to talk about different, you know, to look at the psychology or the psychological or the sociological side of this. And so if you are somebody who is, you know, you're trying to find out, I'm trying to find a trusted source or a neutral source. That can be really difficult depending on how you're defining that.
That's a good point.
But I do want to say studies, research studies, especially through academic research that are done at universities, by professors, at hospitals, that information is publicly available. It's not hidden behind, I mean, depending on what source you go to, it could be hidden behind a paywall. But honestly, if you see who the researcher is who conducted that study, and you really want to know more, what you can do is Google that person's name and the title of the study. That will bring up likely a PDF that they have published on their own website. Right. Or if you are wanting to, you know, say you do some research and you know, a person keeps popping up, or you find someone at a hospital you'd like to contact, oftentimes going straight to the source, they're just thrilled that somebody's reading their study. So a lot of times they'll just give it to you for free and you don't have to pay for it. So this information is out there. And if you are looking at a source and you're like, yeah, I'm really buying this, but you want to check to see if it's legitimate or not, check to see what resources they're citing. If they're not citing any, like they didn't get the information from a research article, from something, and it looks like they just did a blog post about it, that's usually just based in somebody's opinion. And we all know how that can turn out. So anyway, sorry, Ezra, just wanted to pop in there really quick.
No, that's really good advice. And I guess, you know, the thing I'd add on top of that is, well, and I'm not trying to contradict what you just said at all, but I think to take things one step further, like I think it's really easy to like Google search a subject and find, you know, one academic paper, or like one academic study that without any context looks like it is convincing you of the thing that you want to believe, if that makes sense.
So look at their sources at the end. If you think it's, again, look at their sources, because legitimate research articles will have, what I mean by citations is it usually will have pages of other research, other studies, other things that they're backing up their theories. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of times studies are just building off of other ones that are already out there. So that can give you a huge tip off if someone is actually just pulling from just their study, or if the study itself and the information is based in legitimate sources.
That's the perfect way to put it, is to look at the research in its whole context. Because what comes to mind is, and again, without making this about like a social issue, you'll see people say, hey, this polio vaccine is dangerous. My proof is, here's a study showing that like an ingredient is bad for you if you eat it and it's in the vaccine. But that's forgetting the context of what dose it's in, how it's administered, how it interacts with everything else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Katie, like you're saying, it's really important to look at the totality of what's out there. And also, it's not, you know, it's important to look at academic sources, but also, you know, you mentioned reaching out to researchers. Sometimes an expert is the best person to just summarize something. So, you know, these institutions will also often have news articles that kind of summarize what the research says so that you don't have to. And as long as it's a, you know, a really solid source, like a hospital or a medical school, you're probably not going to be led astray.
Right. Yeah, that's all really good advice. I think it's really easy to get excited about something that's going to fix your problem. Whatever that problem might be, whether it be you're very fearful of coronavirus or you're very fearful of, you know, obesity, whatever it might be, it's playing on that fear. And so using research, and while it does take a lot of time, if it's something you're putting into your body, or it's something that you feel like you're seeing some red flags for, it's absolutely worth taking. And honestly, with the internet, it takes hardly any time to see if something is a quality source or not. But
you just have to know what you're looking for.
Exactly.
I think is a big piece of it. And not, honestly, I wasn't taught about this until I went to college. So right. Had I not gone, I wouldn't automatically know how to search for specific resources. And, you know, like we've said before, knowledge is power.
Right.
Arm yourself with as much knowledge as you can.
I think in this, we can absolutely cut this out if we need to, but I think one of the most important things for me when looking at these schemes and the people that fall for them is it's really important to kind of humble yourself a little bit and think, I could be wrong here. Even mm-hmm. like, I'm not saying self-doubt, because absolutely if your whole heart's in something, but if you're then go with it. But at the same time, if you aren't 100% about something, doing research and maybe admitting that your initial thought could be wrong is a very important first step to keeping yourself safe and keeping money in your wallet, let me tell you. So, amen. All right. Well, and with that, thank you all for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to hear more stories about the biggest scams in history, how they worked, and how to stay safe from them. Until next time.